One of the things when somebody says, well, what do you do? And like, as a joke, I'll be like, well, I take a bunch of people who won't talk to each other and make them talk to each other.
What you just heard was a little taste of this fascinating episode. I was able to sit down with Chaya, who's going to introduce herself, who her job is to be prepared and to think about situations we don't like to think about and to be prepared for situations that we may not like to think about. Being in the emergency field, she has the privilege to be able to work with so many different personnel from different departments, and she shared a lot of insights on what it's like for emergency personnel. How are they mentally prepared? Which definitely applies to each of us too. There's so much that goes into it, being prepared and anticipation and communication and logistics and egos and how do you process afterwards. And there's so much that goes into the brave men and women who are involved in emergency work. I think this is very fascinating. She had a tremendous amount of insight from her experience. So I welcome you to this episode. This is Mental Filter. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Mental Filter. As you heard in the introduction, you got a little taste of like what we're going to talk about. Basically, we're going to talk about situations that you probably prefer not to talk about because you hope that they never happen. But it is important to talk about it, and not just to talk about it in this particular approach to it or this particular person's job who it is to do this, but it applies to all of us and how we sort of view like potential negative outcomes. So anyway, I'm really glad to have our co-host today. If you can just introduce yourself to everybody.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Chaya Gitzel-Deitch. Professionally, I go by just Chaya. I was born in Israel, lived there for 6 weeks. So I really consider myself a Baltimorean. And I was raised in Baltimore. I'm raising a family in Baltimore. Really love the community here and so much about Baltimore. And I guess that's kind of how I got into serving for Baltimore City as an emergency manager. I dedicate a lot for the city of Baltimore. I really care about it.
Fantastic. Thank you for being here. So for those who don't know, what is the layman's description? What is an emergency manager?
So emergency management really grew after 9/11 when emergency services needed to have more and better communication between either different levels of government, also public services versus, you know, private citizens.
Right. So what happened from, you said it started after 9/11?
For the most part, emergency management, the Office of Emergency Management used to be civil defense. There were, you know, different components to it. But after 9/11, there just was a significant need for all levels of government and also different agencies and public and private partners to be just be able to coordinate better, to talk better, especially in the time of emergency. So that's when emergency management really started to grow. And then I'm sure you've heard of FEMA, like that's federal emergency management. And then each state has their own. So Maryland is MDEM now. They used to be MEMA, but now they're the Maryland Department of Emergency Management. And then each local jurisdiction will have emergency management. So we can like trickle it all the way down.
So are you saying that before 9/11, it was like to each their own and there was no intercommunication at all?
No, there definitely was intercommunication, but it wasn't the same type of streamlined. So it wasn't like a department or agency dedicated to just making sure that this communication flow is happening. This kind of just built, so as Homeland Security built, it just kind of built the communication and really the preparedness also aspect really falls under emergency management. And the need for it was so visible. And so that's before they did have, you know, communication. I don't want to say not. I personally was in middle school, so I can't really attest to what was happening. But no, I just, the need for it was so great to really have the emergency starts on a local level. So I mean, 9/11 is just a bad example for so many reasons. But if you look at 9/11, the first responders were the people who were there, right? The fire department who was there. And so you need your local level first responders to have tools that they need until state, federal, other partners can get there. And so this was kind of streamlining and making it easier for a local jurisdiction to be able to just turn to their next jurisdiction and say, I need you now.
Right. So, I mean, this is going to be the understatement of the century, but this highlights for everybody listening, whether you work for the government or not, just how important communication is. Good, healthy, clear communication on all levels. It's not just like a nice thing to have and a nice thing to do. This will help prevent so many problems, so many disasters. I mean, I see it all the time. Like with proper communication, there's so much angst and so much conflict that could have just been completely prevented if only we're able to communicate in a clear way, be on the same page. And we wouldn't even get to that point where now we're doing damage control to try to figure out what to do now that we're in this big fight or whatever it is.
Right. No, that's exactly, like, it's unbelievable to see how many times like a disaster will happen because of a lack of communication. I mean, I'm not a expert on 9/11, but I do know that the terrorists were stopped within a day or two in the United States, and they were on a flag list for one level of government, but the local level who stopped them had no idea. So just to like understand what that means, this kind of makes everyone talk to each other. One of the things when somebody says, well, what do you do? And like, as a joke, I'll be like, well, I take a bunch of people who won't talk to each other and make them talk to each other. But that's ultimately when you're in emergency mode, you're not thinking, hey, let me see what you have available, because maybe you have more things available that will help me, instead of just taking control and running with it yourself.
I love that. I love that. And let's use that, because the same way, like, because I want people to take it and like be able to apply, you know, on their own, in their own little lives. So communication is so important. But also what you just said is super duper like on target, that when there's crisis, then that higher level of thinking or that luxury of being able to sit back and to process and is not available necessarily. So even on an individual level. So the more you're prepared before, the more you sort of work out these things before, then when something does happen, you'll be better prepared for the situation. I tell this to people all the time. And it's much harder to be motivated to do all that work when there's not a crisis. All of a sudden, we get all motivated when there's crisis. But you're not going to be able to access, even if you have those, because you're just not going to be able to access them when you're in crisis. Okay, we're going to get into all the weeds here. How did you get into this? You just like woke up one day and say, you know, hey, I want to
be an emergency manager? I wish. I was a very quiet, good, well, not necessarily academically good, but a good student when I was younger. But I always, like, there was something about first responders and, you know, there is that adrenaline rush when you're like involved in emergencies, and something that I always was interested in, but I had no idea that emergency management existed. To the point that like my undergrad was focused in psych, my master's business and human resources and project management. I had a dual focus, which is not at all emergency management based. And when I was looking for a job, I had a couple of people who told me like, hey, you know, government really does have good benefits. And I was starting out and I was a young mom, and you know, time, like even just the way they deal with like holidays and stuff, like you're just, it's a good place to work. And so I was looking online and I'm trying to remember, it was the logistics planning coordinator for the Office of Emergency Management in Baltimore City had come up. And I was reading, you know, some of the details, and I was like, everything they have written, I'm technically qualified, but there is no way that I'm qualified for this job, because like, it sounds way too cool. And I remember I even said something about like driving lights and sirens. And I was like, what? Like somebody combined things here. Like this doesn't make sense. So actually, when I applied for that job, I usually apply like through the portal. Hope I'm not getting anyone in trouble in here. But this was years ago. I decided it said like on the bottom, if you have any questions, please reach out, and it had an email address. So instead of applying through the portal, which I didn't know was already closed, so my application would have went nowhere. I didn't know that. I emailed the person, and it was a very, I have to dig up that email one day, but it was a very funny email of like, I'm from Baltimore City, and we used to be the city that reads, because that's what we were when I was in elementary and middle school. I think now we're Charm City. We went through some different names, but it was just like a very funny email, which you really could say was kind of my cover letter. And, just I'm interested in, hearing more about this position and blah, blah, blah. This is who I am. And, my resume is attached. And a few weeks later, because we're dealing with government, it's not days. So if you apply to things for government, don't expect to hear back like right away. I got a phone call, and we had a phone interview, and then I was called to come in. And I remember even then being like, it's not going to go anywhere. I was, you dress professionally for your interviews. So I was dressed like very professionally, and I had heels. It said to come to the office is underneath the fire station. And it gave me an address. And I was like, I don't know what that means. Fire station must be upstairs. It must be like, but that just didn't make sense to me, but I'm gonna show up. And I showed up to a firehouse, and I was like, this doesn't make sense. So I remember in my heels in the rain, circling this wet grass around the firehouse, trying to figure out like, where am I? And the firefighter actually came out and was like, can I help you? I was like, I'm looking for, Mary Lesser. And she was the executive assistant at the time. And he was like, oh yeah, come with me. And he brings me into the firehouse and like across the bay to these like steel stairs going down into a dungeon. And like, you can't even see the dungeon because it's like you go down like five stairs and then turns. And like, some of the lights were broken, cobwebs. And in my mind, I'm
Sounds
like,
like a
this,
horror film.
right? In my mind, I'm like, run. Like, this is where in the movie everyone's yelling at you, like, don't go. But like, I didn't know what to do. Like, I felt so dumb. And so I walked down the stairs. I don't suggest that in the future. Worked out for me, but. And you're in this like steel bunker, and there's like this one door, like there's nowhere else to go. It's a little landing. So, it turns out that was the Office of Emergency Management at the time. They've since upgraded to a beautiful facility. But it was under a firehouse. And I remember when they opened the door and I was like, you feel like you're walking into an office. Like, how did that just happen? But I was put in a conference room and surrounded by monitors, and everything said purchase with Homeland Security funding. And I sat because I knew I was being monitored. I knew there were cameras everywhere. So I sat with my phone like tilted towards me. What is emergency management? Who is David McMillan? Because that was who was interviewing me. Turns out he was the director. But that interview went very well. Afterwards, David became a very good mentor and friend of mine. He's since moved to work for the federal government, but he was director and he ended up hiring me. He told me that it was one of the best interviews. And I was like, yeah, because to me, I didn't even know what it was. So I wasn't nervous because I didn't know what I was interviewing for.
Sometimes the less you know, the better.
It's not a joke. But after that interview, and it went very well, and you can tell when interviews go well. I told my husband, I was like, I don't want to apply anywhere else. I want to work there. And he was like, okay. But, after like 2 months, because you don't hear from them, it's again government, you don't hear from them right away. And I was like, no, I'm telling you, I want to work there. I don't want to do anything else. I want to be an emergency manager. Then I got the call.
You got bitten, and that was it.
Yeah. Once I found out that this agency existed, I didn't even know.
So, what were some of
So.
the responsibilities in that first job?
So, in the first job, they And just to be clear, like I ended up building up within in that job. So I started as a planning coordinator for logistics, and then within 3 years, I became the section chief because nobody was fulfilling the logistics roles. The biggest thing that I was originally brought on for is that all grant funded, especially Homeland Security grant funded items need to be tagged and tracked. And there are some smaller things that are like, monitors, computers, desks, stuff like that. But then you have some very significant things like robots, sonars, which is like a body detection for underwater, like for drowning victims and things like that. And you're looking at, millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands. And so they really didn't have somebody that was just overseeing that. They had people who were detailed, which means they were within the fire department and then they would work overtime, like a day or two a week. But there was really not a system and they really needed that all organized. So that's originally what I was brought in to do, but there was really nobody specifically doing logistics, which is so important. It's like operations can't run without things. So that was my original what I needed to do.
So then it evolved, like how's it grown over the years? Because I know when we spoke before, it's like it's evolved in a lot of additional things. So what are some things that's involved into, and we'll get into the weeds of some of that, because that's some of that stuff is really fascinating to me.
Yeah, so early on, I realized that it wasn't just about tracking and tagging, but there was more follow-up and what needed to happen service plan-wise with things that were purchased. And so I started just becoming more and more responsible for items and then quickly learning the reason why these items were needed or these items were purchased, but really, if we had a better trailer to store it in so that we can quickly deploy, as opposed to we purchase these items, but now they're sitting in a closet and it will take us 3 hours to transport. And also, the director, Dave McMillan, was very into us. Any education that we wanted, he was like paying for us to go. He wanted us to learn. There's Basic Academy for Emergency Management. It was a 2 week, all day, not course, but
Like a boot camp.
yes, we learn quite a lot. And, from going from there and other classes, and then also getting thrown into emergencies because we did have capabilities. And I learned very quickly that there needed to be more planning involved in and in what we were purchasing, what we need, and the best way to deploy it.
So you, part of a big part of your job sounds like you're one of the people that has to try to anticipate what kind of crises and disasters there are, who are the personnel that need to be involved, what are the resources we need to help with that disaster, and what's the best way to deploy the personnel and the resources so that you can, as quickly as possible, resolve the disaster. Is that
That's 100%. And just to be clear, so a little over a year ago, I became the director of emergency management for the Baltimore City Sheriff's Office. But these, like, start talking about starting up and how I was referring to like when I was working for emergency management for the city, it's a different department. And the sheriff's office is, right, it's state, it's a sworn entity versus the emergency management for the city. But I need to anticipate, and there's a lot of good exercises out there to really be able to figure out what I need to be prepared for versus, what's something more high risk for my area versus other areas. Like we're not prone to earthquakes, and please, if we have one today, do not blame me for saying that. But we're not. There's another part of the country, right? So like they prepare significantly more for something like that. Also, like hurricanes. So hurricanes in Florida, they have an unbelievable emergency management coordination center. And that's not something that we prepare for. In Baltimore, one of the things that is on high alert is civil unrest. That's something, or significant elevation of crime during a event. These are things that we have to be more prepared for, not to say we don't prepare for weather, because definitely in the winter, That's a huge deal. There's practices and there's tabletop, there's different exercises. But yeah, to really know what you're at risk for and then to plan and practice on it.
Right. So if I can, okay, another great thing that I want to use to draw a parallel to people, you know, people listening, because I work with a lot of people with anxiety. So it's perfect what you said. Like, we need to be prepared based on where you are, sort of what our risks are. There are some legitimate risks. There's some higher risks. There's some lower risks. There's some that are minimal risks. And there's nothing wrong with being prepared for a risk, something that legitimately, objectively, we should worry about so that we can be prepared. But people who have anxiety will take like one little nugget of information that I one time heard that it's possible that we could have an earthquake. So therefore, I'm going to prepare my entire house for an earthquake. Whoa, that's like, that's disproportionate. So there's being prepared and then there's being, you know, overprepared. And I don't know if you ever came across, I mention this to clients all the time. There used to be this show, I don't know if it's still on, it was called Dooms Preppers. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
I'm sure I know the concept.
It's, you got to check it out. It's basically, I don't know if there's any such thing as reality TV, but basically what this show was, it traveled around the country and it met with different families who, for whatever reason, they decided that this is what doomsday is going to look like. It's going to be, you know, a nuclear attack. It's going to be a tsunami, an earthquake, a tornado, a storm, or whatever it is, starvation. And they literally dedicated all their money and their resources and their time to prepare for that disaster. You know, a bunker, canned food, weapons, I don't know, whatever it is. And like, that's your life. So in your mind or in the people that you work with, how would you compare sort of the way you think of crisis and disaster than maybe the average person thinking of a crisis disaster? You maybe like daydream and about, you know, disasters like, oh, that's a good one. You know, maybe we should like, you know, think about that. How would you compare the way sort of you think about it and the average person?
Yeah. So it's funny because there are certain things where people think of certain disasters and I'm like, yeah, not losing sleep over that. For example, my sister is a social worker. She oversees the child's earlier development for OHEL, which is in New York. It's like a mental health
agency.
Organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was actually on maternity leave and got like called back right before COVID. And because of things that were coming in. And I remember we were talking and I said something to her about like, honey, the schools are not going to be open after Pesach. And she was like, you can't just have, like, from a mental health perspective, schools just aren't closed. Like, you can't do that. So what? Everyone's going to have to just repeat the grade? It doesn't work like that, right? And it's funny because to me, I was like, I'm looking at this from an emergency management standpoint. We will not have answers. You know, schools are closing for 1 month. They are not opening after that month. And she's looking at that as like, we're blowing that up. And it was just funny because to the average person, that does make sense. If I wasn't in that field and somebody was like, hey, by the way, you know, schools are probably gonna be closed for the rest of the year, I would have been like, what's wrong with you? But then there's other emergencies that they read up on and they're like, we have to stock up on food. Why?
I'm old enough to remember Y2K.
And yeah,
like, great example, you know, and let's be real. Also, there are people that profit from that, from
100%,
from
major,
from pain.
But also it does a little bit like make me laugh about how much more now we're reliant on technology and computers and right. And back then, like, let's say electricity went down. It's not the same as all electricity going down in 2024. And it's just funny. Like, I remember people talking about it and it's going to go dark.
Don't worry about it when we hit 3,000.
Right.
So I don't know. What are all the different types of emergency personnel that you just come across off with? Different departments, different personnel?
In general?
Yeah.
So everybody. So the closest agencies on a local level that you're going to work with, it's going to be law enforcement and fire. Fire EMS local in Baltimore is the same. I know some places it's separate, but that's who you're going to work with the closest and maybe plan with. But then, you know, you have Department of Housing, you have Department of Transportation, you have General Services, you have every single entity will be involved. The Health Department, shouldn't forget about them, but everybody will be involved to some level if there is a mass event. So COVID was like a different level. But even, you know, we had house explosions, which ended up being gas explosions. But at the time, you know, you weren't sure what they were. And every local entity was there because it really ultimately, if you think about it, involves everybody between health department and housing and obviously fire and police. And then you also have your surrounding jurisdictions that come in to help. And then above, you also have private, because locally we have Baltimore Gas and Electric, right? So they're there. That's a private entity. So really, when we think of a larger scale emergency, you have to really have connections to everyone or know who to call to immediately get in touch with them. That's like the biggest, I feel like one of the biggest misconceptions with emergency management is that people are like, oh, so basically you have to know everything. But no, 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 no. I have to know who knows, or I have to know who I can call who will know who knows. Like that concept of I can't make 5 phone calls to figure out who has the equipment that we need. I need to be able to call the state, right? You should call state emergency management, and they know this is the closest place that has that piece of equipment. We're getting it to you. So
I love that, because that also applies to everybody, is that we have to accept like what we don't know. And that's fine. We don't have to be the hero. We don't have to be the martyr. And it's perfectly okay to be able to just access the people who do know. And actually, that's more efficient. But if we feel like we have to know everything and we have to be able to do everything, A, we're going to get burnt out and we're going to get exhausted and we're going to be very down on ourselves. It's also just not going to work. So in a way, we need to get over ourselves a little bit.
And also,
or we need to be secure enough with ourselves, like, okay, this is my role, this is my job, and connecting. And like you said, that's part of running a good business. That's part of running anything, really.
Right. No, 100%. It's a matter of, one of the things that I tell people a lot, especially people who are like entering the field and we're just overall talking about emergency management or really anything. Like right now within the sheriff's office, there's a new administration. There's a new sheriff after 36 years and he's excellent. And just bringing a new culture. And one of the things that I've said to so many people is, it's okay to say, I don't know. And even if it's your job, it's still okay to say, you know what? I don't know. Let me get back with you. Because that happens to me quite often right now, because I went from city emergency management, which covered everything, but usually would start with the fire department, whether it was a bomb threat or bomb scare or hazardous material or fire, and then slowly add on to bring more and more entities in to assist. And now it's predominantly law enforcement, right? The deputies, the sheriff's office. And there are a lot of things I don't know. I had to learn a lot about the judicial system because, quite frankly, I don't know a lot. I think that's a good thing because it means I haven't been to court. The most I know is that I've been a juror. I've never been selected, but I've like, you know, gone for the day. I really don't know. And I don't know people's positions. And that's okay for me to say, I don't know, but I'm working on your evacuation plan. And so tell me, you know, you tell me what this would look like for you.
Right, right, right. It's so true, because what happens is when someone doesn't know and they can't be okay not knowing, then one of two things happen. Whether it's, let's say my child comes and asks me a question I don't know, but I think like I should know everything. Or one of my staff members has something come up in a session with someone and they don't necessarily know. So one of two things happens then. Either they give some made up answer, which is misleading and unhelpful, or even it might be unintentional, they'll try to like sidestep it or dismiss it, and then the person's not going to get the answer or the help that they need. You say like, you know what? That's a great question. I don't know. I can work on finding out. You know, and that's it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. So I want to ask you about even more like detailed about like, so you come across a lot of different emergency personnel. Anecdotally, have you seen, do you feel like emergency personnel like attracts certain people? You mentioned way earlier about like there's a certain adrenaline rush in emergency. Do you feel like there's, not to label them and put them all in one bucket, do you feel like it attracts a certain personality or certain like to the field?
100%. And I feel like so many fields are like that, right? Somebody who is interested in the mental health and they want to help people, right? Like that. It's interesting, though, to see the breakdown between who chooses the fire department, fire EMS. Again, I bunch that as one, and who does more law enforcement, whether it's a sheriff's office or police or federal agents. It's interesting to see because there's this funny dynamic between the two of who is, more macho. I'm saying that very liberally, but it's funny, but it also is all in good humor. Like it's like, but they still, there's a ton of respect. I actually was just speaking to a deputy about this last week and about how he would never want to run into a burning building because there's fire. But then again, they're shooting and he's running towards it. When, the firefighters sometimes have to go towards it to some degree, but they're not running towards it. And it's funny to see who chooses what, but ultimately, both fields is somebody who does do well with the adrenaline rush because some people shut down. And I've worked very closely with some emergency managers who they're more on the planning side because they are happy to plan for it. But the moment that emergency hits, they're like, I don't want to be here. Like, here's the plans. This is what we plan for, but I'm going to stay in the office and assist like that. I'm not going out to the field. I don't want to see that. But there's many people who are a little bit more like me, where it's like, no, I'm on scene, I'm there, and I am very task oriented. This is what needs to happen. And so it's going to happen. We're going to make it happen, but I'm there in the field. But it's funny to see the dynamic. And ultimately, I do think that sometimes firefighters and law enforcement could have swapped positions. It's just that they choose to go for one. And like one of my mentors, he was a lieutenant in the fire department and he retired and he was emergency manager actually in the White House. And he's a great source of knowledge. And he's also a Marine. And so he told me that when he was, I don't think you don't say leaving the Marines, but he was no longer active duty, right? I think if I say the wrong term, he's going to come back at me and be like, I'm still a Marine. Once a Marine, always a
Completed, he
Marine.
completed his service.
Yes.
All right.
And he afterwards was like, I know that I can't go to law enforcement because I'm going to shoot people. And so I'm going to become a firefighter because I know that, like, and it's very, very funny because I could see him as a Marine 100%. And I have no doubt in my mind he didn't abuse his powers at all. Like, that's not, but people, they know themselves. And it's like, no, I'm going to do the burning building. I'm going to save people that way. And then there's others, who are like, no, I'm going to the law enforcement
That's
side.
very health. I think it's very healthy. So he's very self-aware and knows what he, you know, should and shouldn't do. And what you said earlier, yeah, there are people that thrive in the, like the pressure environment. And some of those people actually, because I've met them, some people thrive in the crisis, but when it's not crisis, they're like they're a mess, actually, and they almost like need the crisis. And I agree, it is interesting how some people get attracted. You know, law enforcement can get used to the dangers and the risks and you know the crisis there, but maybe not, you know, in a fire, which reminds me of so many different clients that I work with. You know, they struggle with their problem, but like someone else's problem they'll be fine with, or like they can understand their anxieties, but they can't understand someone else's anxiety. So we all like, you know, we all get used to like what we're, you know, being challenged with. So to build off of what you just said, so then if I'm a person who does thrive in an adrenaline, and if I am one of those people who does thrive, you know, in those crisis adrenaline situations, how do you see them sort of managing? There's like adrenaline rush, and then And then like nothing. And generally, then nothing. How do they manage like sort of the, the ups and downs of that?
So I worked really for 7 years with the fire department, and the adrenaline rush, especially in Baltimore City, you're going out. I mean, if I'm going to underestimate this, but even like a slow area, a slow firehouse, you're going out plenty of times in the 24-hour shifts that you're on. It might not all be a raging fire, but you have your lights and sirens, you're going, there's an adrenaline rush with that. Somebody is having chest pains, you don't know what you're gonna come into. And so they get enough of that that I feel like when they then go home, right, it's like, okay, I'm ready to see my family, see my dog, see my, go shopping, do whatever, that downtime is. I think the harder part of the adrenaline rush, and I've seen it, I've done it. I always say, as much as I've seen and gone through is nothing compared to my colleagues who are firefighters and, have experienced these atrocities and or losses of colleagues, and that adrenaline rush is harder to come down after when there's like when it was a hard scene, when it was personal or even just a hard scene. You're coming away from an accident and there's this child that is gone, and you're the first one there, and so you're dealing with the body, especially, I mean, because the child was alive and didn't make it or whatever it is. It's that adrenaline rush is harder to come down from.
Is there, I imagine that it varies between departments. Is there a way, well, how do they either prepare them, whether it's when they get into the field or whether it's before an actual event and then after an event, how do they help them, prepare and then maybe debrief? I'm sure you've seen or were aware of people where they did struggle to manage or to separate between work and home or they didn't sit and process it. So, how did they try to prepare both before and after?
So it's a big part of the academy side. Even in emergency management, there's a big part of the mental health side of making sure that you have your outlet. So, how do you feel grounded, right? When you're in this high intense, quick unfolding emergency, and you're seeing things that should never have happened, right? And it's hard, especially when there's children, or family members who are there, waiting. And so there is that training. I will say that what I've seen and think carries so many people is that your unit, you have to be like family. And if you're not like family, and then you feel like you're floundering. So, when they go out, they are like a cohesive unit, and like, we're doing this together. We're at this, facing this together. I've seen enough that I wish there was more, for the, it's not just the debrief, because the debrief is there, but for even after that, to really carry certain people, when they've, sometimes it's too much. But usually, because you have that like brotherhood with each other and it's a close-knit group, then you're able to process afterwards together. One of the things, I mean, I say it as a half joke, but I'm like, but I mean it, is I can't even tell you how many people I'm like, you need to go to therapy. And then all of them respond and they're like, the therapist would run out of the room if they, and I'm like, but at the same time, there is a therapeutic side. I'm sure you know much more about this. I've seen people being able to heal somewhat from being with that group. Like in that group, like we're a family. And I've also seen families struggle because, you know, their fathers, mothers, sisters, girlfriends, boyfriends, like they're not the same. So whether it comes on quickly, like they've gone out to an event that just really shook them, or they lost somebody in their unit right there and then, they don't, you know, they're not the same person that left in the morning. And I wish there was more that could be done. Like, I know for me personally, I do have a cohesive unit with people that I work with. And so I know that, like, you can text at any point, you know, or if we're not in the office, you call and just say, I need to talk this through for a minute. Cause, you know, what I just saw is my head can't handle this right now. And I've done that quite a few times to the person I spoke about earlier, who was a mentor in emergency management for me. And I'm like, I just need to talk this through. He's not even with the Baltimore City Fire Department anymore. He's moved on emergency management wise, but like, can we talk? Like, we left this horrible scene and I just want to tell you what I saw. I wish I could be like, oh, there's, you know, the best systems in place. But I know from a neighbor who works with veterans, he works in the VA, and he's like, you know, there's not enough. There's not enough done for these people who have witnessed or had to deal with like some things that people can't even wrap their head around.
Right. So it could be those like those sudden intense thing, could also be over the long period of time of like getting like worn up, just seeing maybe not the most tragic, but tough things, and then building up over time. You mentioned way early, you meant use the word macho. I'm sure maybe sometimes that plays a role into, well, you know, going to the therapist's office. And then unfortunately, I don't, you know, however you're comfortable sharing is like, well, if they're not doing that, what do they turn to? Like, you know, how else do they cope? A lot of people use substances to help get them through. We don't want to like call anybody out or anything, but I imagine that over the years you've
definitely seen that, and it becomes a running joke. But as somebody who, like, you know, alcohol, or I do find that it's more alcohol than anything else, especially because you do go for random drug screening. So alcohol is out of your system. You know, you go home and, yeah. But they do, it's very much used as like a reset, but it doesn't reset. And I don't want to give too many details because I want this person's like identity to be protected. Sure. But somebody who I worked very closely with since the beginning when I started in emergency management. But then during COVID, he was handpicked to run the COVID warehouse, which like we were building, and a phenomenal person, a dad, a husband, a friend. And I knew that he was struggling, and there's many different things. One of the things also to understand, and I found this a lot with the fire department, is that everybody relies on them. So fire department was always looked at as, oh, well, they can do it. Now, it always cracked me up because I'm like, yeah, they do it by going in the other room, YouTubing how to build this thing that we're now using. And then they come out and do it, right? They're like self-starters, and the fire department they are. And it's like, in a way, I want to say macho in a positive way with that, because they're not going to sit by while you're trying to figure out how to get this machine to work that is going to save lives. They're going to YouTube it, and they're going to come out, they're going to build it, and then you're going to be like, wow, they know how to do it. So it gets a little bit hard because, not a little bit, it gets very hard in the fire department because you get called to, you're working all the time, right? During COVID, I can't even tell you the team that we had by the logistics warehouse, like what they did, they saved so many lives, not even realizing, because they just do what they do. And I found out after that one of these people who had to go through rehab and then for whatever reason wasn't really not clean, I guess, after, or no, was maybe incarcerated and then whatever it was, came back to work and wasn't 100% clean, and he was let go. And to me, like, I still, like, it hurts because I'm like, this person was so vital to so many steps and within the COVID response. And we really had best practice during COVID. We had people calling us to figure out how we were doing what we were doing. And I understand that I was the one who said, I need a warehouse. They're the ones who made it. Again, knowing who to ask, that's ultimately what it was. I went to the two people who were the brains behind any of these type of equipment, and the amount of work that went into that, it played with him. You know, you have people all the time then saying, well, I need this from you and this, because you know that he'll go Google it and figure out how to do it. You know what I mean? And it really hurts that I'm like, this person deserves medals. And this is what he turned to, which is
very
really
hard
unfortunate.
To see people who just are so, so, like you said, so valuable and done so much, and like it robs them. Really, really
it
robs
does.
Them.
It does. And I think also they don't get enough gratitude. And as much as people try, people don't understand what they're going through. And I think that that also is just like this, there's this feeling of being taken for granted so often. And to understand that, and I see now with the sheriff's office, the deputies, like what they do. And there's things that they're not going to talk about because that's part of the job. But what they do is, it could be so difficult. And, you know, they say, how do you sleep at night? Well, some people find different ways, and it's hard.
Yeah, there's definitely, it never, the work never ends on how to either process, how to compartmentalize, how to, you know, separate work from home, how to, you know, all those things are like, I don't think that ever really ends. We're starting to run out of time, but there's so much more that I want to ask you about. Well, two things on the lighter side, if I can ask you, it sounds like there's this like almost fun, creative part of the job where like if there's, you know, emergency, so identifying a potential scenario, and then can you just take, you know, not in full depth, but like walking through the steps, if like, okay, identifying a disaster, and then okay, what would it look like? And then you mentioned about almost like reenacting it, and then that teaches you, like, can you just walk, do a quick run through of what that would look like?
Yeah, no, and that is actually really fun. So there's different levels of exercises where you'll like play something out. So for example, we had a tabletop exercise, which means everyone gets together, all like the big stakeholders or whoever will be involved in an event. And we'll sit together and discuss, you know, if this incident happened, and different people will start talking and then, you know, just kind of talking it through. But that can elevate to something called a full scale exercise, which is really fun, where I'm thinking right before COVID, we had one at the local racetrack. So it was just a huge area, and it was a mass shooting. That was the theme. And they had people who were, they had actors, they had a lot of college students.
I was just thinking that. Do you have like a movie director and it's a set and you have actors and action? That's what it sounds like.
It's almost it's like that, except there isn't a specific movie director, but they're like, okay, we need X amount of people who have this type of wound. And like, I actually have pictures, like there's somebody whose arm really looked like her bone was sticking out, and they have professional makeup artists, and people come in with these like wounds, and they were scattered about this huge area. And then there was somebody from the police academy who came in, and he was just shooting blanks. He wasn't actually shooting, but it definitely sounded like it. And then the local and surrounding jurisdictions came in for this event, and how you triage, because and there's different color areas, right? So how you set up, and you put this person in one color area where you know, like, hey, they're going to be fine, but eventually, like, they could wait a little bit. This person, you know, needs to move now. This area, they're dead. And you have all of that played out. And then you actually have evaluators. So they're watching. And it was actually so much fun. Sounds terrible. Nobody really died. So it was so much fun. And it was full scale to the point that there was a hospital not far. And they were actually transporting these people to the hospital. And there were tents set up outside of the emergency room, not blocking any real emergencies. And then the hospital staff had their staff having to play into this. And some of their staff didn't even know in advance. So it's really like, what would you do if this happened? These tents were set up and now you have to go triage these people that are coming in and you have to.
So it goes from like concept to then talking about it to then full scale and then evaluating so you can then be prepared.
So and evaluating and going back to the drawing board of like, what could we have done better? And
so interesting. I'm laughing because, you know, I have clients who I'm trying to discourage them from thinking of worst case scenarios because they're obsessing about it. And here in this case, it's important to think of worst case scenarios so that you can practice and prepare.
And there, but that actually is a lighter side, even though some of the stuff is hard, but there is a lighter side. That's, you know, those are the fun things. We get to come up with disasters, and you don't want to have dinosaurs coming through the street because it needs to be somewhat realistic, but it's really fun. Like, you know, you set up explosives off. I wrote up one once and I don't even know, it blew up this whole area. It was really fun, but these are the documents that don't get out.
Right.
Because exactly. They're not interested in people being like, wow, she's a real psychopath.
That's great. Okay. I have one final question, which I think you touched on. So you have to be almost this like liaison connector between lots of different personnel, the stakeholders, you know, who knows the things. And I have to imagine, like, what are some of the things you've learned to help sort of cut through? And like you said in the beginning, like part of your job is to like get people into the room and make them listen to each other. Like what helps with that, both to make people listen? Sometimes you have to really, probably really assert yourself. How do you like help manage, you know, egos? Because there's a lot of egos in the room. And then after the fact, you know, maybe this doesn't apply to you, but as human beings, I imagine that certain people want to take credit for certain things. And I can only imagine that that can become sticky. So what are just some of the things, you know, we won't spend 20 minutes on this. What are some of the things that you've learned that help manage all that?
So the first thing is like in the time of crisis, but needing somebody to listen, right? Or to come together and say, I need you to be a part of this conversation because we need to figure this out now. The number one thing is to have a relationship beforehand. It's not always possible. Even surrounding jurisdictions, like, you know, we've been in enough exercises, even events like incidences or that you try, it's very, very important to maintain good relationships. And the world of emergency management is small enough that like somebody's heard your name. So, you know, there's conferences, there's so that is to me, number one, it's that interpersonal relationship so that when you do turn to the person, and I have had to do this to somebody who at the time, yes, as an emergency manager, you now supersede them. But in reality, they're the top of their food chain. And so they don't want you to, you know, and to be able to turn to them and say, I need to speak with you now. And they know that that's coming from a, hey, Chaya does need to speak to me and not a, you know, this is a power play. But that's not always possible. And quite frankly, and then there are some people who quite frankly are not so interested in, you know, and, but what ultimately ends up happening is you just, sometimes I have to be more assertive than I like and just very firmly put on that mom voice of, no, seriously, like, it's like, you know, your three-year-old's having a tantrum and you let them tantrum and then you say, okay, now please go pick that up and go back to your room. Right. And so that is, I let them talk about how, I have an example in my mind, but about how he has to deal with his people and this and that. And I was like, okay, I understand, but I need you over here now. And at that point, it's like, they're still an adult. And they also ultimately, people want what's good. They want a good outcome. So they're seeing now that I'm just telling them like, this is the way we got to go. But it is a funny dynamic, especially because I don't view myself as super assertive. Maybe some people laugh now, but like I really still view myself as that quiet high school girl. So it's funny to me that like sometimes I turn to these people who, you know, you'll see on TV and you know they're briefing there and you turn to them and say, well, this is what you're gonna do. But ultimately, the last piece of that is I always give the person respect. So I understand that you are, you know, the honorable majesty, king of the world, right? I get that that's your title. So I will refer to you in that title. I will never turn to you and say, you. I will never, because sometimes you are dealing with, you know, feelings. Maybe we can call them egos in certain manners. And with my purpose is to see this done in the most efficient, quick way that helps preserve, you know, quality of life, people's, I mean, life to begin with, but then quality of life, and then also, you know, protecting property and all that. So by me going off on you is like not going to go anywhere. To be fair, though, I will then go home and tell my husband. I will like go off and be like, you can't even imagine, you know, and he's amazing. He listens. He listens to me. But thank
That's
God.
not to be understated.
No, it's not to have that person that you can just be like,
By the way, that was actually one thing on my mind going into this is like, does it change things if you have two spouses or two partners that are both in it? It might make it even harder because they both live that life. Sometimes, I mean, I can see it working both ways. Having a partner who's like not in that world, but maybe they don't necessarily understand, but they could be like a sounding board. And then having someone who's in that world, they can understand, but it's also like they're in that same intensity. So I can see it working both ways.
yeah, no, I mean, for to me, especially being like a mom, I think I can't see it working, having two in the field because then you're both on all the time, right? So like I always say I have a lot of flexibility until I don't. I don't know when I won't. So like, but my husband being like his position, he is usually able to take that space when needed.
So I wanted to just highlight what you said right before that, before I interrupted you, was that it's always possible to be both respectful and firm at the same time. They're not contraindicated, and sometimes people mistake that. Like, no, you could be firm and you could focus on what needs to happen. You can still maintain respect at the same time. That is doable. And then last but not least, anything about like people wanting to take credit?
So again, I'm gonna go back to like I still view myself as that quiet high school girl. I really so like to me it's like what well of course I'm not gonna like who am I to right? But I do see it happen to other people who I'm like, you didn't do that. He did that, right? Or like let's just get this straight. But ultimately, that's part of interpersonal relationships that you're always going to be working with people. Or you're always going to be with somebody who is going to want to have attention. Like ultimately, that's how I look at it. So, you know, there have been like I was asked to speak at a conference once, and right before there was like something that had come out about during COVID that, you know, and they gave a lot of recognition to a specific person. And I was like, it wasn't that person. During the conference, I brought up the people who really did. The people who really did complete what needed to be done. They may not have had the ability to sign their name on the bottom of the document, but they did everything. And sometimes that's my little, like a little got you. Like I get back at you. And like, and because like the conference was, you know, the people that mattered. Like it was a Homeland Security conference. It was other people who, you know, I want them to know that this person is who to think. And but I kind of look at any of those type of things like everyone has their own agenda. Well, but a lot of people have an agenda and you have to learn how to work with all these people.
Yeah, that's life. You have to learn how to navigate that.
Right.
That's
I don't have to be the one to call you out on it, but also what I've seen is that people know. Like, no, they do. People know when it's like, certain people taking credit, and maybe not the first time, but like usually the second, third time, they're like, oh, really? That was all you.
It's not sustainable, and the people who need to know will figure it out, and hopefully the people who do the work, like you said, do get recognized.
Right.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much. This was great.
Yeah, no, thank you. This
If
was.
anyone listening now all of a sudden is really inspired and wants to know more about emergency management and all that stuff, like what would be a good place to send them?
Well, you can always just look up emergency management because it is local in all places throughout the US. So, like, somebody could be on the West Coast and they'll have a local emergency management agency. And the truth is that even we've had this where somebody will just call up and say, I'm interested. I didn't have a position right there and then for them, but they actually came in and interned and stayed. And so it's actually like, it's a small field, but it's very much needed, and has really good publicity out there. So I don't want to say who to contact because each location is different, but if you look it up, every location has emergency management.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.